Your MC tonight is Eileen Borkman. Eileen has spent over 30 years in the Air Force, much of which was used as a test flight. She was a test flight engineer, spent much of her time out at Edwards Air Force Base. You're in good hands with Eileen, and you guys are in for a great show. So without further ado, let's welcome Eileen Borkman to the stage.
Thank you, Chris. Oh, what a great crowd. Oh. Tonight, we're celebrating 30 years of women in combat in the United States. Before we begin with our special guests, I'd like to tell you a little bit about the 50-year journey to open the door for women in combat. And it was a journey that took place on a very crooked flight path. Let's go all the way back to World War II, when the U.S. military turned to women to meet wartime needs. Women served in all branches of the armed forces and the Coast Guard. And as many of you know, a group of more than 1,000 civilian women, the Women Air Force Service Pilots, ferried aircraft in the U.S. and flew other support missions. According to the laws that Congress passed to bring women into the military, the women were supposed to be booted out at the end of the war. But the service chiefs, including Dwight D. Eisenhower, some of you have probably heard of him, they wanted to retain some of those women so that they could use them as a base to build on in the event of another national emergency. In 1948, Congress passed laws to allow a small number of women to remain in the military, as the service chiefs had asked, but they also passed a law forbidding women from serving on ships or aircraft that engaged in combat. That law also severely restricted the number of women allowed in the military and limited their promotion opportunities. The services seemed to have little use for women during most of the 1950s and 1960s, and many women who did serve endured largely condoned practices such as harassment, sexual assault, and strippers' nights in military clubs. However, there were some bright spots. Legislation passed in 1967 paved the way for more women to join the military and opened the door for women to become general officers. In the early 1970s, women made strides as the end of the draft collided with the women's movement and the Equal Rights Amendment. Supreme Court victories at about the same time also allowed women to gain more equality with men in the military. In 1973, 50 years ago, 6 women entered pilot training in the Navy. The Army soon followed suit, but the Air Force dragged their feet until 1976, when 10 women entered pilot training. But the laws prevented the women from flying combat aircraft, no matter how well they performed during pilot training. The 1980s was a decade of change, and this is when I came in, was in 1980. Women began flying their aircraft into hostile areas. With the lines of combat blurring in modern warfare, confusion reigned as to what women were and weren't allowed to do. In 1987, a new policy allowed the Air Force to open new jobs to women, and they started flying the C-130 tactical airlift aircraft and the U-2 spy plane, and they could also fly airdrop missions and transport aircraft. But combat aircraft still remained out of reach. And now I'd like to introduce you to one of the women who was an Air Force pilot during this period. General Jacqueline Van Ovost is the commander of U.S. Transportation Command, one of 11 combatant commands in the Department of Defense. She is a 1988 graduate of the United States Air Force Academy and also a graduate of the U.S. Air Force Test Pilot School. She has a diverse operational and training background, including commanding an air refueling squadron, a flying training wing, and the Presidential Airlift Wing. She is a command pilot with more than 4,200 hours of flying time in more than 30 different aircraft, including the C-141, C-17, C-32, KC-135, and KC-46. General Van Ovost, the floor is yours. Thanks.
Thanks, Eileen. It's great to be with you again and to have an opportunity to sit up here with some amazing women and outstanding aviators. You know, I started my career in general aviation. I had 1,000 hours in my CFI before I went to the U.S. Air Force Academy. And when I joined the Academy, I wanted to join the competitive flying team. And when I showed up for tryouts, the all-male team asked me, "Why are you here?" Now, they were dismayed. They were surprised at the fact that I had this much experience. And they were frankly relieved when I could not be on the flying team because I was overqualified. As it turns out, if you're a CFI, you cannot compete. At that point, I went to the Aero Club. I became an instructor there, and I started teaching the individuals on the team how to be a team and how to do well. And you know, and after USAFA, I went to pilot training. I had two other women in my pilot training class, which was great. We worked together. My CFI put that to use. I helped them in the simulator. I helped others learn instruments and whatnot. But when I graduated, I put down on my dream sheet every fighter aircraft that the military had, because at the time women could not fly fighters. But I did not want the chain of command thinking that I got my top choice. That, you know, even though my class ranking said I could get my top choice, I absolutely could not because I was a woman. But then I set my sights on test pilot school. And so I chose the airplane that the only female test pilot I knew, Eileen Collins, then became an astronaut. She went to C-141s first before she went to test pilot school. So I focused on being the best C-141 cargo pilot possible. I went to Charleston because they flew combat operations in the C-141 there. And I walked in as a second lieutenant to my operations officer, and I said, "Sir, Lieutenant Van Elvis reports to duty. I want to fly every mission you have, every dirty mission, you know, every task, every weekend, every holiday. And as soon as combat is open to women, I want to fly airdrop. Because airdrop allowed us to insert cargo and passengers and people, warfighters, behind enemy lines or seize an airfield. You're flying low level with an airplane, you know, the size of a cargo airplane," which I thought was the coolest that I could do at that point. So I also flew in the Persian Gulf War, where we were at higher risk but not considered in combat. I loved the heavies, but test pilot school was calling my name. So following test pilot school selection, not only did I get to fly my top choice, I got to fly all the fighters in the Air Force, new and old, and MiGs, and even the Goodyear blimp. But you know, I was not quite received at open arms like my male counterparts, my male fighter pilot counterparts at test pilot school. Even though at that time, fighter pilot positions were just opening up for women. Now, one particular day, I was flying the F-15, putting it through its paces, doing some high performance maneuvers and some basic fighter maneuvers. But as a previous heavy pilot, I didn't have a lot of experience flying basic fighter maneuvers, and so I was struggling in a few areas. So when I got done with that sortie, we got down, and I was devastated when the F-15 instructor said to me, "You know, women don't need to be here at test pilot school, women pilots, right? You don't need to be here, and I suggest that you quit." Well, that wasn't my plan. I was a little shocked, a little devastated, but I picked myself up. I leaned on my fighter pilot peers who all told me I had the talent, I had skills, and you could absolutely do this, right? So, man, I buckled down, I persevered, I remained focused, and I worked with my peers to get better on every level so that the next time I flew with this instructor or against this instructor, it would be game on. And that's how I took the rest of my time there at the school. But I did like the crew dog life of being a mobility warrior. In fact, as I think about it, as Eileen mentioned, in August of 1991, there was an amendment to the combat exclusion policy, which permitted women to fly. However, the services did not enact it, right? So there was a little confusion. It was authorized by law, but the services were not employing it. So between 1991 and the complete lift of that policy in 93, there was sort of a loophole that women like me flew right through, right? So we got a lot of combat and combat support roles. And I think about way back when, we actually had women flying combat, sitting alert duty for Strategic Air Command back in 1978. First Lieutenant Sandra Scott was the first woman to do that, nuclear duty. And in 1983, Captain Rogers, with her C-141 crew, evacuated victims from the Marine Barracks Beirut bombing. So there were all women, and for those who come before us, that gave us these opportunities to fly and fly into combat. And as recent as the Afghanistan non-combatant evacuation, where we pulled out 124,000 people in 17 days, right? We had a team of men and women flying those mobility airplanes that did that. In fact, five women were rewarded with a heroism with a Distinguished Flying Cross for their actions during the Afghanistan NEO. So we have come a long way. I am immensely honored and proud to have served with them, with amazing aviators, with aviators who chose to push back, right? With aviators who press forward, and aviators who refuse to accept no, right? Because history continues to be written, and everyone here tonight that's gonna join us will share story after story of women absolutely crushing it as combat aviators and warriors. Thanks again, Eileen.
Well, thank you, General Van Ovis, for those great stories and insights. As you just heard, the Persian Gulf War in 1991 was a turning point for military women. The war dispelled any remaining doubt that women could fly in combat. In fact, the war made the public realize that women were already in combat. The war concluded at the end of February, which was perfect timing to slip a provision to reveal the combat exclusion laws into the 1992 National Defense Authorization Act. Congresswomen Pat Schroeder and Beverly Byron did exactly that, and the bill sailed through the House. So the fight in the Senate was a little harder, but a bill to repeal the law also passed there later that summer, as General Van Ovis mentioned. Unfortunately, the Senate also passed another bill that created a presidential commission to study the assignment of women to combat roles. This is what you do in the service. If you don't want to do something, you study it. If you don't like the answer, you study it again. So in the meantime, the services would not have to train women in combat aircraft until the commission presented its findings. At the end of 1992, the commission recommended that flying aircraft in combat remain closed to women. The women, again, put their dreams on hold, but not for long. After Bill Clinton was inaugurated as president in January 1993, the new administration ignored the commission's recommendations. Finally, on April 28, 1993, Secretary of Defense Les Aspin held a press conference to announce that he was directing the armed services to begin training women in combat aircraft. And despite being one of the most vocal opponents of women flying combat aircraft, Air Force Chief of Staff Merrill McPeak had his own announcement to make. Could we put the picture up, please? So, I thought we were gonna have a picture up there of General McPeak up there. He decided to announce the first three women fighter pilots that same day at that same press conference to get ahead of the power curve there. So I would like to welcome to the stage the three women who were present at that announcement. First Major General Jeannie Levitt, an F-15E pilot and currently the Chief of Safety for the Air Force. Retired Colonel and former A-10 pilot and former Senator Martha McSally, and retired Lieutenant Colonel and former F-16 pilot Sharon Presler. And I guess you can pretend I was General McPeak, I don't know. On stage here now. So our first three women fighter pilots in the Air Force, in the U.S. Air Force. First, General Levitt. So could you tell us about your journey that started with being denied the opportunity to fly an F-15E and ended with being on that stage with General McPeak? So.
Sure. Well, I graduated class 9304, and it was a transition time. So rather than put a dream sheet in, we would actually be rank ordered first to last and then make your selection based on merit order. So when I finished first in my class, I was told very clearly I could not pick a fighter, a bomber, or special ops because they were combat coded. I received an unbelievable amount of unsolicited advice. All of my instructor pilots said, don't even think about asking for that fighter. They all knew I wanted one. They said, you will ruin your career. You will go nowhere in this Air Force. All the instructor pilots except one, who happens to be next to me. So then Captain Martha McSally pointed out to me that the law had changed, and so I could stand up and ask for it. And she said, if you really want it, you should get it on record. And so I explained to my leadership that I had to, because I didn't want regrets. I did not want to not ever ask for the fighter, because it wasn't if, but when. Mm-hmm. It was going to change. It might be weeks, months, years, but I didn't want to have the regret of having never asked for the airplane. So I asked for it. I was told no. Took another assignment. I went to fly the KC-10 at March Air Force Base because at that time, they were not going to have any more first assignment instructor pilots. That lasted one class, and then the next class they had some. So they switched my assignment to a T-38 instructor, and then in April of 1993, I got a phone call with the great news that I was going to go fly in the F-15E Strike Eagle. So, great.
That's great. Thank you. So, and I did not know that you had gotten that advice from Captain McSally. So that's wonderful. So, yeah. Let's go with you next, Colonel McSally. So you were a T-37 instructor pilot, right, when you were selected to fly the A-10. So can you tell us about your own journey? So,
absolutely. Yeah. Well, let me say I first went to the Air Force Academy with Jackie, and I thought I was going to be a doctor. And when I found out it was against the law for women to be fighter pilots, I was like, well, that's exactly what I'm going to do someday. Don't tell a girl she can't do something. Just put your sights on it. So it was a long journey, 4 years of the academy, 2 years of grad school, then pilot training. Congress repealed the law while I was in pilot training. So I thought I was going to be able to pick a banked fighter at the time. We were doing a massive drawdown, so they were sending pilots off to the bank for a few years and do non-flying jobs. But they were like, no, you can't do that because we still haven't changed the policy. So I picked a T-37 instructor pilot job to Del Rio, Texas, where Jeannie was going through pilot training. And that was making a bet. For all the young men and women out there who have a big dream, and sometimes it looks like there's barriers there, for me, I just had to like keep the dream in my heart, keep blooming where I was planted. And it was not a glamorous assignment to pick T-37 instructor pilot, but I wanted to keep the dream alive, keep building my flight experience, because I just felt like it's going to change. And so first I got to help with Jeannie as I watched everybody praising Jeannie. She's amazing. She's number one. She's brilliant. Until she said, I want to pick the F-15E. She's awful. Like, you know, she's oh, this is miserable. I was like, you got to do it. So I was grateful to be your wingman at that critical time. So I got a phone call. I was just in the flight room one day, like landlines, and they're like, Cat McSally, and I'm on the phone. It was the general, I think he was the A1, General Bowles. Mm-hmm. Hey, we're about to change this policy. We understand you wanted to pick a bank fighter. You qualified for it. You know, you're in the ranking to be able to earn one. Are you still interested? And I was like, I'm flying T-37s in Del Rio, Texas. What do you think? Like, of course I'm still interested. And he's like, you can't tell anybody, only your commanders know. You've got to fly to DC tomorrow, get your uniform together, we're going to do a press conference. So everybody's listening to my end of the conversation. Of course I want to be a fighter pilot. And I hang up the phone and everyone's looking at me and I was like, wrong number, you know. I run out of the room and my commander like, oh my God, it's happening. So it was literally almost 10 years from the day I entered basic training to the day I took off in an A-10. But I kept that dream and it finally came true.
That's great. Thank you. So. Okay, Colonel Presler, so you actually told me a pretty funny story earlier about getting selected as one of the three. Can you tell us a little bit about your journey?
Yeah. Sure. First, I would say that when I picked my assignment in pilot training, I actually asked for an F-16 to be determined, which meant banked. I wasn't quite having as much forethought as these two. I was just kind of being my normal smart alecky self, and I loved the F-16. But that served me well because I ended up going to a Learjet C-21, And I had been on vacation. I came back from vacation, and there was 4 messages on my answering machine. You know, back in the day before cell phones and answering machines. And I started listening to them, and the first one was from my boss. Would you call me as soon as you can? And I thought, you know, I'm on vacation until tomorrow. But then the second message was from him, as was the third and the fourth. And each one got a little more urgent. And I thought, vacation or no, I better give him a call. That phone call led to a call to the colonel, who was the exec to General Bowles, who asked me if I would like to go fly that F-16 I asked for in pilot training. I'm like, are you kidding me? So I got home from vacation in Hawaii, and the next morning I was at that press conference. Well, actually, that was a day and a half later. The next morning I was in General Bowles' office with these two, getting told that the combat exclusion was lifted and we were going to get to go fly fighters. I was shocked and amazed, and luckily for me, had no idea what I was getting myself into, because we got ourselves into a lot. But I'm very happy it worked out the way it did.
Thank you. All right. So, Colonel McSally, just a quick follow-up. So you were the first woman to officially log a combat sortie flying a combat aircraft. So, and I realize some of the details might be classified still, but can you tell us a little bit about that experience?
Yeah, I'll have to kill you. No, yeah, yeah. I mean, well, let me just say, I do have to go back to that picture, because obviously we looked pretty, General McPeak had just testified before Congress that he'd rather pick a less qualified man over a more qualified woman. Yeah. And now here he is standing next to us saying, well, what a great day. And we're like, yeah, whatever. we went through a bunch of media training, and they were like, watch your body language. And I was like, yeah, it's live. Watch my body language now. So that was on purpose, those side eyes there and our grim faces. But, you know, we all took our paths. We were just talking backstage. You know, there was no email, no cell phones. This is our first reunion in 30 years, you guys. The first time we've been together.
That's awesome. 30,
yeah. First time. And we didn't even have the mechanisms to support each other, right? We go like, I'm going to write a letter to Jeannie. How are you doing? I'm in my trench here, you know, fighting the good fight. So we just went on our journeys, and we were all just trying to show the plane doesn't care if you have ovaries or not, you know, just fly the plane and shoot straight. So I went through my A-10 training, and went through the training before that, and then pretty quickly my squadron was deploying. Saddam, this is in between now, Desert Storm and Iraqi Freedom, but this is a time frame where we were enforcing the no-fly zone. Saddam Hussein was threatening to come south, so they sent a squadron of A-10s from another base to go like be a deterrent for the air-to-ground mission into this bombed-out little old base in Kuwait. So I want to say I'm less than 90 days a combat-ready pilot. I want to say it was like 60 days. And they're like, we're deploying. And I was like, okay. You know, and I was brand new in the squadron, just mission ready. And, there were some challenging transitions. Leadership does matter. So when the chief of staff's got a bad attitude, you know, sometimes you can have some issues, you know, down the ranks. So it was a little challenging. I was just trying to show that I was capable, I was competent, just like all of us. Deploying actually helps, because when your lives are in each other's hands, some of the nonsense about like, you know, career and being threatened, it's like, no, like we've got a covenant, flight lead and wingman and squadron mates, we're here together for a mission. So it really helped break down some of those barriers to be accepted. And look, I didn't know at the time on my first mission there, I didn't care that I was the first of all of us to deploy. I was just trying to fly my jet, stay alive, make sure I came back, you know, and I did the mission. So it wasn't until much later that when everybody kind of looked at the timing of everything, they said, hey, by the way, you're the first to do that. But look, we're all grateful for those who went before us. And it doesn't, you know, those first are important, but the WASP, you know, paved the way for us. Others who went before us flying paved the way. Jeannie was the first to graduate. So we're all in this together to show the plane doesn't care if you're a boy or a girl.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay. Okay, so thank you for sharing your stories about being the first. So, and now I'd like to introduce 4 women who have more recent experiences flying combat aircraft. So let's welcome to the stage, retired colonel and former A-10 pilot, Kim Campbell. So. Major Michelle Curran, a former Thunderbird pilot, who some of you may have heard talk earlier. You know, what are some of the other reasons why we want to have women in combat aircraft as well as men? So, go ahead.
I think the best reason is that gender-neutral fighter pilot selection gets you the best people to give you the best team. It's not about breaking barriers or proving a point. It's about building the best combat Air Force you can.
Anybody want to add anything to that? So I think that's about the best answer you could get. So yeah, that's okay. Okay, so I'm curious how attitudes towards women flying combat aircraft have changed in the last 30 years. We've got 30 years worth of combat flying experience on this on the stage here. So can you share some of your experiences going through combat training and then getting into your squadron? So I think Colonel McSally, you talked a little bit about that already, but you know, maybe some of the issues that you might have encountered. Go ahead. Yeah,
I can start. I think first, let me say that I'm thankful that there are women who came before me because I realize the many challenges that they faced. When I went into my first fighter squadron on day one, I knew that I was going to be the only female fighter pilot in the unit. And I personally put a lot of pressure on myself. I thought that that I would ruin it potentially for the women that followed me if I made a mistake or if I failed in some way. Knowing that there were still women who came before me, that was the pressure that I put on myself. And so I committed to working really hard. I, you know, spent time studying. I was in the vault. I was always in the books. I wanted to be a good teammate. And I realized more than anything that it was credibility that mattered. And when I went into that fighter squadron, many of those pilots were classmates of mine from the Air Force Academy. Many of them I had known from different areas of my life. And the reality was that the guys in the squadron just wanted to see that I could perform just like everybody else. As Martha said, the jet does not know the difference. And it turns out the guys in my squadron, they didn't care about the difference either, as long as I was credible and capable. I will tell you that once I deployed and proved myself in combat, like, it was kind of the end of the discussion. It didn't matter. I was able to prove myself in combat very early in my career, which was beneficial. But I looked at these guys like my brothers. I would do anything for them, and I know they would do anything for me.
Okay, thank you. So,
I'll throw something in there just because I was kind of the first going into each of the training programs, and I really did carry the weight of the world because my biggest fear was messing it up for anyone that was coming behind me. Yeah. And so I put a huge amount of pressure on myself, and because I just wanted to do my best and work really hard, and it was fascinating because there was a lot of resistance, I will admit. There was, it was not being welcomed with open arms. But the first people who started to accept me, interestingly, were dads of little girls. And so it was always like, I wouldn't say this in front of the guys, but I think it's cool what you're doing. Because I have a little girl, and I'd never want someone to tell her no if she was just as good as the guys. And I'm like, thanks. But I wish you would say it in front of everyone else, you know, and the credibility part, I would say, is key. And so in my case, I think what really helped was when I went to weapons school, because it was very competitive to get in, very challenging to complete, and forever in a, you know, day, whenever I knew people would come into the squadron, they'd go, oh, that's Tally, that's my call sign, that's Tally, she's our weapons officer, and she's the first female fighter pilot, which got a little old. I didn't want to be known by timing and gender. But when I got out of weapons school, and I remember they were introducing the new lieutenants, I was the captain, much more senior now, instructor pilot, and they go, that's Tally, she's our weapons officer, and she will kick your butt at BFM, you know? So I was like, yes. I really just said, hey. But I was to myself, I'm like, yes, being defined by my abilities, not by my timing and gender.
Great. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. So I think that they did a really good job of proving that women could fly these planes. And that piece of it they covered. And then once I finally got into fighters, I hadn't even thought about that I was still kind of on the front wave. Not them, but there was still very few of us. And one of the things that happened was in my squadron, I was in Korea. And occasionally, you know, like I remember one guy coming up to me and he said to me on a Friday, he's like, hey, are you going to the roll call tonight? And I'm like, well, yeah, what else am I going to do in Korea? Of course I'm going to go. And he's like, oh, good. And I was curious why he said that. But there was a cultural change when I was in the room. And he actually appreciated the fact that things were a little bit cleaner, a little bit nicer. And I'm not saying like it wasn't like super PC at this point, but even he was offended by some of the stuff that was, you know, so it kind of changed the culture to be just more professional along, you know, along the lines of where we should be as fighter pilots. And we still have a lot of fun, don't get me wrong.
Okay, anybody else have anything you want to add to that one? So, okay. So now let's hear some stories about flying in combat or even just flying into a hostile area. So I don't know if you've got anything, General Vanovost from Desert Storm. So
Yeah, actually in Operation Iraqi Freedom, I was flying the KC-135.
Okay.
And so night one, going into Iraq as the bombing was going on. And although we tried to keep the tanker force, because we can't shoot as tankers, we just, you know, are trying to dodge. So we have no defenses. So we stay out of the weapons engagement zone, mostly. And so as we were kicking off Operation Iraqi Freedom, there were some fighter pilots that, and this wasn't in my airplane, but it was in the formation, that got below their bingo, which is the fuel that they need to, they have to turn around and come back to the field, and they got below their numbers because they were engaged. And so we had to send tankers forward inside the weapons engagement zone because that was the right thing to do because they were running out of gas. So I think about, you know, how it didn't matter who was in the tanker. It was like which one was the closest and how quickly can we get to that F-15E that hung out too long and ran out of gas. But you know, there were more and more as this was going on, because they were so engaged, they started to get below the numbers and became a little more frequent that tankers had to go in and get a lot closer to pull them out of that engagement zone. But every save, we'll take it, right? Because it's teamwork, whether you're in the fighters or whether you're in tankers or in the cargo airplanes, this is teamwork to make the mission happen and whatever it takes.
Great, thank you.
I'll say, you know, flying the A-10, we got a lot of hot
pilots. Yeah, it's a lot of A-10 pilots.
Yeah, Casey's got a great story. Yes. But I'll just say, like, big picture, every mission is different. Most of my combat time is in Afghanistan, and we would take off with the maps of everywhere in Afghanistan on our dashboard, and, you know, often would be on a routine combat mission, and then somebody's under fire, they got a call sign, a radio frequency, a grid coordinate, these guys need help, and we just show up to provide that close air support, whatever they need. Often when they're on the move, in very close proximity, good guys and bad guys, the risk of us hitting the friendlies are high. There's a lot of fog of war and chaos that's happening. There's times we're using amazing technology where we're working with drones at night with night vision goggles and infrared targeting pods, and they're marking with infrared, and we're talking to somebody who's literally north of Las Vegas handing off the target to us. And there's other times where we had guys on the ground pull out a pocket mirror and flash the sun into our eyes and say, here's where I am, don't hit me. The target's like 100 meters north. So, I mean, lots of combat, different stories and missions, but Casey's got a great one. We want to give enough time for her to tell.
Well, first I'll say that for General Vanovost, I might have been one of those A-10s that was low on gas and needed fuel, and I am forever grateful to the tanker pilots who came to get us, because that would have been really bad. You know, I think if you talk to many ground troops, they will tell you they don't care who's in the airplane, right? They want the close air support. They want an A-10 overhead or another aircraft platform, but they, you know, they want that support. They don't care who's in the cockpit. And, you know, for me, being a young wingman, I really didn't know if I was even going to fly missions. I thought maybe I would go deploy and work in the mission planning cell. But we needed every pilot we could get during Operation Iraqi Freedom, and every mission was intense. As Martha mentioned, we would get called up to go up to Baghdad, and we would just wait. We would wait for the call. And very frequently, there would just be the kind of the screaming over the radio that ground troops needed help. And I will tell you that any A-10 pilot, really any close air support pilot, is going to get in there as fast as they can. Mm-hmm. And I just happened to be on the mission the day that we got a troops in contact call. Our ground troops were taking fire. They needed immediate assistance, and we were going to do everything that we could. Unfortunately, the weather was terrible, which means we couldn't see the ground below. At the A-10 at the time, we had to be able to see the ground to employ, and But the call went out, right? It was troops in contact. They were screaming for close air support. And so we were going to find a way to get below the weather. We found holes in the weather and made our way through. And as soon as we got down below the weather, we could see this firefight. There were bright flashes and smoke and tracers going back and forth across the river. And it was very surreal. I mean, this is everything that we train for. It's what we plan for. But now we can actually see it. A little bit lower than I normally was because of the weather. And I remember my flight lead very quickly just saying, we're going in with guns, wedge shooters guns, which was our formation. And it was like, you know, that little bit of anxiety of like, I don't want to screw this up. You know, they're troops on the ground, they need us. And at about that time, I start to see these puffs of gray and white smoke and then some bright flashes that are in the air now next to our cockpit. But we have a mission to do. So we continued with the mission. We put firepower down on the enemy. And as I was pulling off target from my last pass is when I felt and heard a loud explosion at the back of the airplane. And I knew immediately I was hit. The jet nosed over, pointed down at Baghdad below. I remember pulling back on the control stick just instinctively, and unfortunately nothing happened. It was just kind of plunging to the ground, completely out of control. Thankfully, this is what we are trained for. You know, we fall back on our training. And I just remember to quickly analyze the situation, try to figure out what's going on, realize I have no hydraulics left on the airplane. They had come out during the missile impact. And at this point, my options are eject, not a good one, or get the jet back into our manual system called manual reversion. Thankfully, flipped the switch and the airplane started to climb up and away from Baghdad. Long story short, after this, I still had to get 300 miles back to home base, an hour of flight time. But that moment of climbing up and away from Baghdad when everything worked exactly as advertised was kind of my first moment of thinking that I would actually survive the mission. Longest hour of my life flying home, for sure. But thankfully, I had a great wingman by my side providing mutual support the whole way back. And the one thing that I remember, he said, Casey, you need to start thinking if you want to jump out of the airplane or try to land it. And I knew that was coming, but I was still nervous. And he said, I have your back. Whatever you decide, I have your back. Later in an interview, he said, Casey's a good pilot. I trusted her. I believed in her. And for a young wingman new to the unit to hear that from a very experienced flight lead, like, that's what it's all about. Because the rest doesn't matter. Landing from that mission, obviously, I was really relieved to be on the ground, but again, the most important thing to me and the thing that I remember to this day is hearing all the guys from my squadron. These were my brothers, and they were all over the radios, totally violating any radio protocol, but just coming over the radios to say, welcome home, nicely done. And to me, that's again, that's what it's all about. It's the brotherhood and sisterhood of doing everything that you can for each other, supporting each other because of the mission.
Thank you. And I actually have my own story about your mission. Is the day after it happened, or within a couple days after it happened, I was a colonel at the time. I was at the Pentagon, and it was a Friday morning, and I was with some other colonels, and we were just drinking coffee, and one of them mentioned, we were in a classified area, and one of them mentioned that he'd read a report about this incident, and he said, her wingman said that she could jump out, but she decided to go back and land the aircraft. And that was the only reference to your gender. Nobody said, oh my gosh, a woman did that? You know, there was no, and these were all fighter pilots, you know, that I was having coffee with. So there was recognition at that time that you know, this was clearly a great pilot, and it had nothing to do with gender. So
yeah, to be clear, yeah. She's being very nonchalant and humble about this. Flying in manual reversion, we have four A-10 pilots up here. It is really badass, okay? Like, it's really hard. It's brute force. You're, like, pulling back. The cables are moving. Like, it takes a lot of internal strength and physical strength. And so it's a really big deal what you did.
So. And how many holes were in that airplane? Hundreds. I actually heard that they did a little bit of examination of it, and the missile impacted the back horizontal stabilizer, sent shrapnel to the fuselage and tail. Probably over 600 holes is what they finally analyzed from all the shrapnel. But again, the A-10 was built for these hits. There was some shrapnel up near the cockpit, which is a little disconcerting, but for the most part, it was all behind, and I couldn't see any of it. until I landed.
Yeah.
You landed.
Yeah. Yeah, which is a good thing you couldn't see it. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, anybody else have a combat story they want to tell before we move on?
So. I'll add one on about teamwork, since that's been mentioned a few times. Yeah. When I was in Afghanistan, like my first deployment, everyone tells you, like you do all these training flights and they're like, but what's going to happen is it's going to be at night, it's going to be danger close, meaning that the troops are, friendlies are closer than you would like them to where the weapon's going to impact. Your wingman's going to be gone at the tanker getting gas, you're going to be by yourself. And you're like, no, odds are that's not going to happen. One of my most memorable employment in combat, for sure, exactly that scenario, danger close in Afghanistan at night, and my wingman left for the tanker because he needed to get gas. And we would wait for on station for 45 minutes or an hour just to get clearance. And so we have our whole game plan sorted out as far as who's going to shoot the weapon, who's going to guide it in with their targeting pod, all of that. And then that plan kind of goes out the window when someone needs to go get gas and now you're by yourself. And I was shooting a rocket from a diving attack, which at night is very disconcerting in Afghanistan. It's just black. You can't see anything. It feels like you're about to hit the ground even when you know you're thousands of feet above it. And I got clearance as soon as he left. So I was like, okay, I can laze this in myself, which we had done in training, but you don't really want to be heads down looking at your targeting pod while you're doing a diving attack. And it's just a lot more room for error to happen. And so I'm, you know, just about to fly another maybe half, 180 degrees around the circle before I dive in. And an Army UAV was in the stack above me, and he chimes in on the radio. Been tracking this whole thing this whole time. And he's like, we can laze that in for you. And within 30 seconds, we had figured out who was doing what, codes were set. We knew the target. We had confirmed it. And I was cleared hot and dropped the weapon, and he lased it in perfectly, and we shacked the target. And I just thought it was such a cool representation of the teamwork that happens between all the different platforms, even though we're not all necessarily in a room briefing and debriefing together because we're at different locations, but we're all playing on the same sheet of music and we all have the same standards that we're following, and that allows us to have that trust, even though I have no idea who that guy was. I've never seen his face. We never coordinated before that very brief radio conversation, and I was very grateful that he was there that night to help me with that attack.
Great, thank you. Okay, let's talk about where we are today. So women in the military have come a long way, as you've heard, but there's still more work to do. Can we talk a little bit about some of the remaining issues? Anybody want to take that on? More work to do? Oh, I'm sorry, yeah, go ahead.
I will. Okay. I've obviously been retired for a while. I retired in 2006, but I have friends who are current fighter pilots. So, I'm not talking about Banshee in particular, but I will share some of their stories with you. The issue that I see the most right now in fighter squadrons is what I call backsliding. So we still have very few women fighter pilots. So sometimes squadrons will go years without having a woman in them, and they tend to go back to that much more locker room culture. And then when the woman shows up, they have to change their behavior. And if you have to change your behavior when someone shows up to your unit, you tend to resent that person. So I've seen some of that now, and it kind of annoys me greatly because they shouldn't have to do and put up with all the same things that we put up with being the firsts everywhere we went, right? It should be more normalized now. So I encourage everyone in your workplace, wherever that is, to make it a welcoming place for the entire team all the time, and then you won't have to change when someone different shows up.
And while I know there's issues, I do want to do one positive story, which was pretty cool for me lately. We did an interview and we were in front of our airplanes, and so I was up in DC and I said, well, Seymour Johnson is the closest place with Strike Eagle, so I went down there and I said, hey, can we get some of the women aviators together, pilots and wizzos, and we'll do a photo? And so they came out, and I'm like, oh my gosh, there were so many of them. And so there were about 18 of them, which wow. When I went, there was one. It was me, right? And they said, oh no, this isn't all of us. This is just who was available today. And I said, how many are there? And they went back and they counted. They're like, there were over 30.
Wow.
So that was pretty amazing. Four fighter squadrons, one fighter wing. But they had more than 30 female fighter pilots and wizzos. So there are places where we are gaining momentum. So that was one good news story from recently.
That's great. Yeah. Any of the younger women want to take
that
one on?
I honestly only have good stories. Yeah. So, like, I'm going to be bold, and I'm going to share this, because sometimes it's a little sporty. But when I got my call sign, I was named G-Spot. It's a flying story, I promise you. Something I screwed up, that's where it comes from. But what I'm getting to is recently I went and visited DM to help with something. And the squad, sorry, Davis Mott and Air Force Base, where they have A-10s. And I met with the squadron commander to work out something. He said, what was your call sign? I'm like, well, it's G. And I'm like, but do you want to know what it was? And I told him, and he said, oh, are you kidding me? They named you that? So to me, that just shows the culture shift. Now, when I got that name, to me, it was all about, like, I'm not here to shake things up. If that's what you guys want to name me, let's do it. Like, whatever, I just want to fly. Just want to fly the plane. It was a little awkward telling my mom, and I'll be honest with you, when my kids look in my office and they're like, what does that mean? I'm like, later, honey, later. But things are slowly changing. I know I keep talking about the culture, but it matters, you know? Yeah. Makes it all so inclusive, so.
That's good. Yeah.
I would also like to share a few good stories, because there were some even in the very beginning. And I would like to say that every squadron I went to in training or at the squadron, I was always the only woman. But there was always one or two of the guys in the unit who were there for me, that I could talk to, that would help me study, that would help me in simulators when I was struggling, that would give me support. And I would say that those guys, and they know this because I've told them a bunch of times, but they made all the difference in the world to me, right? So if like the guy in Genie Squadron would have actually supported her more publicly, it would have made a big deal. So if you see somebody struggling and you can give them a little hand, you can make the world of difference to someone else, just like people did for us. It really is a huge difference to have that kind of support, even if it's just one or two people.
Okay. So, Colonel Wendy, ask you a little bit of a follow-up there, because you talked to me a little bit earlier about careers outside of active duty. So you recently transitioned from active duty into the Guard. So did you want to talk a little bit about that? I mean, was being a woman any part of that, or were there just some reasons that you and wanted to go do that, and just talk a little bit about that? So.
And thanks, Dr. Borgman. For me, it wasn't a gender-based decision. It was just, I had an awesome opportunity on active duty, and had opportunity to see the world and fly a number of different aircraft, but was approaching kind of the decision point in a career, and trying to weigh, a lot of folks talk about like the opportunity cost, if you will, to a decision. But in reality, a different approach is, what are you optimizing for? And for myself, I was looking to have a bit more stability, but also still a desire to continue serving. And the Air National Guard, just as the Air Force Reserve, provided that, and provided that opportunity for me to have an opportunity to live closer to my family, and then also have the bandwidth to pursue other personal and professional opportunities outside the military. And I think that gender agnostic is kind of one of the advantages of the total force, if you will. And we have a very slanted panel and an amazing opportunity to tell our combat experience today, but in reality it's a team, and not one each one of us needs our wingmen and the support infrastructure around us. And just the opportunity to continue to serve is just outstanding.
Thanks. So that's a great point, that that you did that not because of your gender, because of issues that you were encountering, because I can't tell you how many women I've talked to over the years that went into the reserves or the Guard because they just couldn't deal with the active duty problems they had anymore. They were perhaps married to a active duty spouse, and it was just very difficult to keep the families together, to balance that work life. And and so a lot of times it was the woman who got out and then wound up going into the reserves. And so it's great to hear that we're getting to the point where those decisions aren't because I just couldn't handle active duty anymore. It's because this works better for me. Yeah.
If I could pitch in on that, we've made some great strides in the services to try to ensure that everyone has a more fulfilling service. And when it comes to family decisions with women, what we're finding is We are allowing folks to stay in place longer, to have a better choices when they have dual military spouses or even joint spouses, meaning you have someone in one service and someone in another service and they're married. And how do we take care of that? We've also, you know, trying to lean into some of the child care issues and the pain points, if you will, that we all grew up with. We're starting to chip away at them. And so we made some pretty great strides. We're not there yet. But you know, our goal is to make it, you know, just as easy to serve and fulfill your dreams in the military as it is at Google. And I just kudos to the leadership who have made that work. And frankly, all the ladies that have pitched in and provided those pain points and are willing to talk about them and help us think through how to fix those things, from anything from having female fitting uniforms to functional flight gear for women, to hairstyles. So it's been a journey, but I'm super proud of our service.
Great, thank you. So one question I have, I talk to people a lot about this, is about 20% of the people in the Air Force now are women, and yet only about 6% of the pilots in the Air Force are women. And I'm not saying that we should have a quota, that we have 20% women. I don't believe in quotas, but it does seem like it's a little bit out of balance. So do any of you have any thoughts about, you know, why that number is so low and what we can do to get more women interested in aviation?
Yeah, I'll jump in simply because I spent a couple of years in recruiting and I see the current recruiting commander over there, so hello, Bammer. So that was very much something that was of interest of Air Force leadership, and they came down and they said, why do we not have a more diverse pilot force? You know, mm-hmm. whether it's women or minorities. It's funny because they call us underrepresented groups, because I'm like, we're 50% of the population, but underrepresented in the aviation careers. And so one of the things we did was stood up a detachment to specifically look at that. Why are more women not applying? And what we found is sometimes there's just a lack of knowledge. So we've really pushed up the engagement and the outreach and education piece of it. But there's also sometimes barriers. And so we looked at what some of those barriers were, whether they were economic or, you know, whatever the case may be, to see what barriers we can remove to make this open, to have a broader pool from which to select. And so Air Force Recruiting Service Detachment 1 to this day does great work. They're here right now in KidVenture, but they do a lot of outreach and a lot of its exposure. Because a lot of young ladies, like I had never even been in an airplane at age 18, and it was randomly that I crossed paths with a second lieutenant waiting for pilot training, and that's how I learned about it. And I didn't even think gender, it was a guy, but didn't cross my mind. I'm like, you're going to fly airplanes and they're going to pay you? I'm like, man, that sounds awesome. And then I went and found the ROTC detachment and walked in and said, I want to be a pilot, having never been behind the controls of an airplane. But I was just convinced I would love it.
Yeah, and I think some of this is just in society, and as young as we possibly can, we were talking about it back there, just encouraging young girls and young boys that they can serve, but that young girls in particular to go into the science, technology, engineering, math, the STEM fields. We all have done a lot of career days going to different schools. I remember one in particular, and they announced it was elementary school. There's a fighter pilot coming tomorrow. There's a fighter pilot coming tomorrow. And all the little boys are like, yeah, yeah, the fighter pilot. And then the principal said, she'll be here at lunch. And the wheels are like turning and everyone's looking at each other. And then the little girls are like, yeah. And so they just assumed it was a guy. And so us just showing up with our gear and being that example to plant that seed, you know, MACE, the air shows you went to, representing the Thunderbirds. It's really a combination of young girls seeing themselves in some more STEM field, mm-hmm. you know, particularly in flying.
Yes. I've heard a lot of people say, well, I can't do that because I want to have a family. Like, they're pre-planning ahead. And I'm like, wait a minute, I have three kids. You can absolutely do this. I didn't say it was easy, but if you want it, you can do it. We can do hard things.
Yep. Okay, let's move on real quick to life after being a combat pilot, and four of you are retired. So I'd like to actually start with you, Colonel Campbell. So Colonel Campbell has a book out, Flying in the Face of Fear.
So, and could you tell us a little bit about how your career experience has helped you navigate the process of writing your book and getting it published this past year? So,
yeah, I think what I realized is that throughout my career, throughout my time in the service, as a leader, as a pilot, one of the things that was so beneficial to me was people willing to share their stories with me. Not just the stories, but like the lessons learned, the mistakes, the failures, the ups, the downs. That moment over Baghdad for me, coming home, I very much remember the stories of the pilots that came before me. I had read books about them, flying in Desert Storm. Pilots had come to the squadron to share some of their stories, but I knew about the pilots that had come before me who had flown in manual reversion. Sadly, not all of them survived, and so thankfully we had, you know, people to share those stories and the lessons learned. You know, we try to learn from all of those things, as terrible as they are. But that's the power of stories, whether it's, you know, these war stories or hangar stories. When we have the courage to be vulnerable and share those things, they help other people. So for me, throughout my career, it was incredible to have those stories shared with me. And I think even just stories about being a mom or a wife, or, you know, trying to do all of these things and trying to keep it all together, it's like that common bond and experience of sharing stories. So that is what led to writing the book. I decided that I almost felt like a responsibility to share some of the stories. That experience over Baghdad, I don't ever want anybody to have to go through that, but I think there's so much goodness that came out of that from a leadership perspective, from a teamwork perspective, and so I wanted to be able to share those stories with others. And I joked with my husband for quite a long time that I would write the book, but I wouldn't have the courage to publish it, which is why I named the book Flying in the Face of Fear, A Fighter Pilot's Lessons on Leading with Courage, because to me, it's those moments. It's what Mace talked about earlier today. It's like, we face fears, we face doubts, we face uncertainty, and it is all about what you do in the moment that really matters the most.
Okay. Did any of the other retirees want to talk about what you're doing now and your path, or so?
I'm happy to. I think about the WASPs a lot and how their story was buried. So my mission after I got out of the Air Force was really to change that storyline, if you will. So if you come upon a forest and you want to go to the other side, you're going to blaze a trail. But if that trail doesn't stay cleaned up and lit, no one can see it, and they're gonna burn a new trail and burn a new trail, and they're gonna get maybe as far as you did, maybe a little further, maybe not. I looked at history and I saw that happening over and over again, and I thought, this has gotta change. So my goal after retirement was, I didn't really want to be in the speaker circuit, but I started a speaking business called Athena's Voice that features military pilots. And the idea is to keep that trail clear, shine a floodlight back on it, so that those that come behind us can take that path easily and get way further than we ever did. So that's really my mission. In addition, I decided to start a business also doing mental performance coaching with aviators, because I think it matters. You can't just pull over on a cloud. So you have to have the right mindset. So I want to make a difference and an impact with the experiences I have. And sometimes as pilots, we think we can only fly, and that's just not true.
Okay.
I retired in 2010. Oh, sorry, Sharon.
You're fine.
And right out of there, I was teaching as a professor of national security studies at a place called the Marshall Center in Garmisch, Germany, in the German Alps, teaching a lot of our former Soviet Union, you know, allies, and, you know, just building relationships with them related to security services. I mean, I was like, a lot of people have a hard time transitioning. I mean, I was paragliding at lunch, you know, I was still continuing to serve and make a difference. And long story short, I was kind of yelling at the television about what was happening in Washington, D.C., and part of our culture is, don't walk by a problem you're not willing to solve. And looked myself in the mirror and was like, well, what are you gonna do about it there, McSally? So next thing you know, I quit my job, got on an airplane, came home and said, I'm running for Congress. What do? File paperwork somewhere? Like, I don't know what's going on. So it's a very long story that was 9 years of my life, deploying to Washington, D.C. for 6 years of that in the House and then in the U.S. Senate. trying to make a difference, a continuation of my service in that crazy dysfunctional place, but still trying to, with the same oath of office, make a difference. And since I am no longer in that place in DC, deploying there, I'm in Martha 3.0. And so for those who are retired or looking at what they're gonna do next, Martha 3.0 is about bringing these lessons into businesses, into teams, the things that we've learned in combat, the things that we've learned flying and leading, and really helping build trusted teams, helping people overcome their fears, find their courage, have an agility mindset through keynote speaking and other things. And also I'm on the board of directors of a few companies. So it's been great. Martha 3.0 is thriving. And I just would encourage anybody who's struggling in retirement, because some people do, their identity is associated with the flight suit. It's okay to let it go and continue to dream, because your future continues to be bright and the world needs you out there with all the experience you have, bringing into whatever place you're called to next.
Thank you. Okay.
Well, I retired in 2006. It turns out I'm actually the oldest one on the panel. Sorry, General. And I did a very typical thing for Air Force pilots. I went to the airlines. I went to Southwest Airlines, and I flew there for 14 years. I didn't really continue to serve, but what I did was spend a lot of time with my family. I had a boy that was 5 when I retired. I have him still, but he's not 5 anymore. When I retired from the Air Force, and now he's 21 and off to grad school. So that was what I did. I traveled, I worked, and I spent time with my family. And now that he's off doing his own thing, now I'm doing back what I call more of service. I do coaching. I'm an adjunct professor at Grand Canyon University teaching coaching courses. And I go out and speak about the lessons that I learned as the first woman in the F-16 in our Air Force. So that's how I give back now. I took a little break for about 15 years and focus on some other things.
Great. Thank you. Okay, I think we've touched on this a little bit, but what advice do you have for any little girls or young women that are either sitting in the audience or maybe somebody knows somebody that would fit in that category, but who aspire to be pilots? So,
I'll take that one to start with. So I spent 3 years not that long ago with the Thunderbirds, where I got to have a lot of amazing interactions with little girls, you know, just being there in the blue suit, and for them to see someone that looked like them was just so powerful. And I learned a lot about what kind of their fears were and their hesitations were, and like what was keeping them up at night when they were dreaming about their big dreams. And so many of them came to me with a little bit of self-doubt and a little bit of fear about what they could go do, but they were drawn to aviation. So they're at this air show, they're in awe, but there's this little bit of trepidation there. And I think when I would tell them about, you know, I joined the Air Force with zero civilian flight time, and I had a lot of self-doubt, I had a lot of imposter syndrome, I think they can look at us, and anyone out there probably looks at us and thinks that we are different than them. Like we get put on a pedestal, that we have, you know, this guiding thing that tells us all the answers, but that's not true at all. We've all stumbled our way along. We've all been in the right place at the right time in different circumstances. We've all failed. We've all embarrassed ourselves. Like, we've all had self-doubt. So just telling them that where you achieve those dreams that you have is when you're willing to step out there and put yourself out there and be a little bit bold. And when you're willing to go after the thing, even though it feels a little bit scary and uncomfortable, because the things that actually make you grow, the things that are challenging enough, are going to feel uncomfortable initially. You're not going to have all the skills right out the gate. And when you don't have that skill gap, your confidence suffers a little bit, and that's completely normal. We've all been there. You just have to go do the thing, even when it feels a little bit scary.
And don't quit.
Don't quit.
I think that's the, I 100% agree with everything they said. You're gonna face challenges on that journey. Like, you're gonna face rejection, you're gonna face failures, you're gonna face mistakes, and it's, you know, it's about getting back up again when you get knocked down. It's about putting in the work and putting in the effort. It's about having this goal and this dream and knowing that it's not all going to go swimmingly. It's not all going to be positive. I mean, I got rejected from the Air Force Academy when I applied. I struggled through air sickness in my early days of pilot training. Like, there were hard things that I had to deal with. And to me, it's like, when you have that goal and you have that dream and it's worth it to go after it, then don't quit. you know, face the fear, do it anyway. It's not always going to be an easy ride. Yeah. You got to put in the work.
Absolutely agree. To what Mason Casey said, you know, positive mental attitude. You are going to go through this. Everyone is going to struggle at different phases in any sort of ascension type program. And that's where then you rely on your support network. And that network may be different depending on the challenges you're facing at any given time. But go and realize that, you know, it is just one hurdle, and then there'll be something next. And that end state goal for I'm going to go do this, you know, I'm going to go be an engineer, I'm going to be a pilot, it's going to be a fighter pilot, I'm going to go fly A-10s, I'm going to go to test pilot school, I'm going to go fly the F-16, then the F-35. It is that framework for let's do it. And thankfully, you know, I was, like many of us, able to, you know, follow the path that was created for those before us. But, you know, it blazes trails in different ways. And that network throughout, whether it's the individuals on this panel that we're so fortunate to be able to learn from today or otherwise, is just the key to success. Because without those two critical parts, I'm, you know, not sure I'd be fortunate enough to be sitting here today.
Okay. Anyone else? Okay. My last question is just a general question. Is there anything any of you wants to add? Anything I didn't ask that you wish I had? So,
yeah. I would just like to tell everybody, as everyone said, you're going to face challenges, right? And I know Jeannie and Martha talked a little bit about the pressure we all put on ourselves being first. So that's where I learned my biggest lesson, which is to focus on what you could control, right? If you're going out to fly a jet, you can't worry about what people are thinking about you or saying about you. You focus on your performance and what you can control, and you let everything else go. And that's when you'll do your best. So when you're facing those challenges, just take a step back and think about what's important. Don't worry about your next flight or your check ride a week from now. Worry about what's going on right now and focus on that. That's the only thing you can control.
Okay. Anybody else?
Yeah, I'll just say, I mean, for anybody, it's not just the young women and the girls, for any of us out there to just add on to some of what's been said, say, whatever your goal is, say it in the present. I am a pilot. There is something neurologically about this. You just decide, I'm a pilot, okay? Not, I'm going to be a pilot, I'm going to try to be a pilot, because then you get the brain starting to give that self-doubt. You, like, put it on your wall in your room, like, here I am with a picture. I just decided at the Air Force Academy I was going to be a fighter pilot, and they said, it's against the law. I don't care. You know, laws change. And that, you just decide you're going to do it, and then all these challenges that everybody have talked about, all these setbacks, they're just ways to go over, through, and around. You keep getting up, you keep moving. You just decide what you're going to be, and you focus on the things you can control, and you will become that. You will. But you can't let this get in the way, because that will stop all of us. Doesn't matter what your gender is.
And I'd like to add something to that, because for me, I set out to be a fighter pilot, and there became a time when that was no longer possible. I had cervical spine reconstruction in 2006, and I left the A-10 and I went and flew RPAs, remotely piloted aircraft. It was one of those things that as a pilot, out of pilot training, we were like, haha, I'm not gonna fly that. It's just the truth. And I never thought I would, but the thing is, when your path changes and it's out of your control, embrace the new path and put everything into it. So when I became an RPA pilot, I thought, oh great, well, I can use my CAS background, and it was very well used. I ended up going into weapons school for the RPA platform and progressing on, and it was amazing. But you have to put your whole self and all of your energy towards that new path if it shifts on you.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, it looks like we're out of time. And I know all of you want to get to the air show, the amazing night air show that we have here. So what you've heard here tonight is just a small part of the history of the decades-long battle to open the door for women to fly in combat. So if you want to hear more, I'm going to be giving a presentation tomorrow at 10 o'clock at Forum Stage 3, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that long history. So I want to thank all of you for participating tonight in this panel. You all have played a significant role in the history of women in the military and women in combat, and it's very much an honor to be with you here tonight, so to hear your stories. So all I have to say is fly like a girl, and please join me in giving our panel a big round of applause. Yeah. Okay.